Welcome. The title of this session is Blogging Where Speech Isn't Free. Speech isn't free in many places, not necessarily the places that you immediately think of. We're going to talk about that a bit. We're going to talk about blogging in countries where you have no expectation of free speech. We think of ourselves in the United States as having that expectation. Yet I think probably everybody is here who has blogged. And how many bloggers do we have in the room? Well, that's amazing.
That's the question.
I'm sure that you've all blogged something at some time where you were kind of looking over your shoulder and wondering if that's really something you can say on your blog. I know I have. And it's not necessarily because you're afraid that the Secret Service is going to knock down your door and cart you away, though I'm surprised they haven't done that with me yet. It could be because you have an employer, or you have a customer, or you have a mom and dad, and you're afraid they're going to read it. We talked about this a little bit backstage, and we realize that freedom is not something, it has a rather liquid definition. It's not something that you can necessarily pin down as being freedom from oppression. The question is how you really find freedom and how every day you have to figure out what you're free to blog and what you're not free to blog, how you have to use your judgment, and how you have to deal sometimes with a concern that what you post will create some problem for you or for someone that you know. So we're going to talk about that quite a bit today. We're going to focus quite a bit on blogging in areas of the world where there is no expectation of free speech, but we know that it's a broader issue than that. Our panelists today are Rob Ferris. I'm going to introduce each one briefly, and then they'll tell you a little more about themselves. Rob Ferris is with the Berkman Center at Harvard, which he joined in 2006. He's focused on carrying out a global study of internet censoring practices, covering 35 countries, in conjunction with folks over at the Open Net Initiative. Secondly, Ethan Zuckerman is going to speak. Ethan and I are both associated with World Changing, and Ethan is also a prime mover behind Global Voices. He is also a fellow of the Berkman Center since January of 2003, and his primary focus is the impact of technology on the developing world. Shava Narod is with the Tor Project, and she's going to tell you a bit about that. She's the executive director. Shahid Amanullah is a tech professional. He's worked with Silicon Valley startups. He worked with Retalia Networks. He's also, though, the founder of Halal Fire Media, which is a network of Islamic-themed websites, and they have over 5 million annual visitors. And finally, my good friend Yasmina Tasanovich has joined the session. Yasmina is a feminist and an activist from Serbia. She's a translator, a publisher, and a filmmaker. So what we'll do is we'll start with Rob, and each panelist is going to tell you a little bit about themselves and give a bit of a presentation, then we're going to go to Q&A. Rob.
Thank you so much, John. It's a pleasure to be here. I think I'm not going to talk about myself, actually, given my 5 minutes. I'm from the Berkman Center, and today I'm going to talk about work that is carried out with the OpenNet Initiative, which is a collaboration of the Berkman Center, the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto, and the University of Oxford in Cambridge. There was a point in time when it was very much hoped that the internet would be a special place, a frontier area that was not subject to the regular rules, that it wouldn't be more particularly subject to national sovereignty. I think that that idea is pretty much dead. And one of the ways in which governments try to assert their sovereignty over the internet is through internet filtering, or more broadly, internet censorship. What we've done over the past year is the first step in the first global study of internet filtering. We've looked at 40 countries in the past year, and we've found internet filtering in more than two dozen of those. Of those 40 countries, perhaps half are filtering issues related to sensitive social issues. Another half are filtering political content, with a prime focus of that being on blogs. You can also see by this impossible-to-understand Venn diagram that there's a lot of overlap between the social, political, and filtering. I'm sorry, the political, social, and security conflict-related filtering. It implies that once you put in the administrative and technical means to filter the internet, you're likely to be filtering a lot more than one or two topics. You're going to, there's a notion of mission creep there. For more information, definitely go to opennet.net, check out the global internet filtering map of the world. It's a work in progress. We're continue to update it as we go along. As I mentioned earlier, we've just completed the study of 40 countries. We find the cluster of filtering activity in the Middle East, North Africa, and in Asia. Internet filtering is a messy and incomplete process. Attempting to target certain content on the internet is just about impossible. And if we want to pause and have sympathy for those who censor the internet for a moment, it's impossible to actually extirpate everything that you want to, and in doing so, not knock out a lot of the internet that's completely innocent, a lot of collateral damage associated with it. For example, when Pakistan decided to knock out the Yahoo hosts that were offending blogs occurred, they also in the process knocked out approximately 52,000 websites. The sovereignty which nation states are asserting over the internet space is also incomplete, which means that the internet remains a relatively free environment when we compare it to the traditional communications and media environment. One of the interesting questions in the coming years is to what extent that divergence will hold, or whether we'll see a convergence between the censorship that normally applied to media and communication and that which is going on in the internet right now. Because of the problems inherent in technical filtering, we see a host of complementary policies, content restrictions, licensing requirements, registration requirements, monitoring and surveillance. All of these policies are intended to induce a climate of self-censorship. It's a very complex set of policies we see around the world. I'll just throw out a couple for your consideration now. One is Cuba and North Korea, where the suppression of opposition views is going to be carried out at any cost. So they've effectively shut down the internet by and large there. A different case is China, where they want to maintain a vibrant internet sector and try to knock out just part of the internet in doing so. And there certainly are problems with that. On the other end of the spectrum are countries which don't filter the internet at all and use a number of other policies to suppress discontent. Cuba, Algeria, Russia are a few of those. In closing, I just want to say that the rules of censorship have changed, and they're going to continue to evolve. And one of the things we're seeing right now around the world is the rules are very fluid and not clearly defined in many places, which not only creates opportunities in some cases, but dangers in other places. And I turn it over to our fellow panelists to take it from there. Thank you.
Cool. Can you switch me over?
Yep. You're number
one, I think.
Number one.
So howdy, folks. I'm Ethan. I actually work in the same office with Rob, although I work on different sorts of things. Specifically, I tend to work on the issue of citizen media, so blogging, video casting, podcasting, any media that individuals are creating. And I particularly focus on the developing world. And one of the things that we consider when we think about the space in the developing world is press freedom as a whole. So here's a map which puts up an interesting contrast to the one that Rob showed of internet censorship. This is a press freedom map from Freedom House, which is one of the two leading press freedom organizations. Where you see green, you have a largely free press. Where you see purple, you do not have a free press. Where you see yellow, you're somewhere in between. And you'll see, for those of us who work in the developing world, we are generally working in parts of the world where there is not a whole lot of press freedom. One of the interesting things about citizen media is that in some countries, it's becoming a space for a free press. And the place where it's been most aggressively embraced are countries of medium repression. And what I mean by medium repression is a highly repressive country, a country like North Korea, Burma, Turkmenistan, has such tight control over society that no one has access to these tools, or even if they did, they're not really going to dare to use them. In countries that don't have a lot of media control, and so again, I'm sticking to the developing world, Ghana, for instance, or South Africa, where you have a largely free and independent press, you don't see people flocking into the online space because they have other places to express themselves, often things like talk radio. But medium repressive countries, and I'm going to put Iran, China, Zimbabwe in that category, you see people very, very aggressively going into this space, because in some cases it's the only space for independent media. Iran is an amazing case study for this. We saw the rise of Iranian blogs in about 2004, where suddenly, and tremendously surprising to people, we saw 60,000 blogs start in the space of a year. What largely happened was the independent press in Iran had shut down, and many of the people involved with it moved into the blogosphere. And this led to really crazy things, like the vice president of the country starting a blog in English, Arabic, and Persian so that he had better contact with his constituents. Now, Muhammad Ali Abtahi is now so liberal that he has nothing to do with the current government, but it was a pretty interesting moment in time. My organization, Global Voices, which is based out of Berkman but is now becoming its own independent NGO, looks at citizen media in the developing world. And we try to link to all sorts of conversations, some of them just about social, culture, fun stuff, a lot of them about freedom of speech, local politics, and put it all up on this website on a daily basis with editors all around the world. Some of the things that we've ended up pointing to in this space, this is a remarkable document that's been passed around Bahrain, which is a PDF file, and it's a PDF of Google Maps. These are Google Maps of land distribution in Bahrain. And what it showed was how much land is actually owned by the monarchy and how those palaces compare in size to settlements that there are tens of thousands of people living in. This was so controversial, it led to Google Maps being blocked for 5 days within Bahrain until people realized that that was actually giving more PR to Google Maps. Here's a project done by our advocacy director, actually, a Tunisian activist named Sami Ben Garbia. Sami is now based in The Hague, and one of the reasons he's based in The Hague is things like this. This is a Google Maps mashup. And if you mouse over it, you can see the public and secret prisons in Tunisia, along with data on the prisoners of conscience who are being held there. Here is a wonderful blog by my friend Alaa Abdel Al-Fattah, who blogged from prison while he was in prison for an Egyptian judicial protest. And he and his cellmates blogged on paper, smuggled this out. And one of the lovely things about this is if you're a blogger and you plan on spending time in prison, I highly recommend having a spouse who blogs. I'm lucky enough to be in this situation, but you know, the reason that Alech was able to blog from prison was that Manal was actually posting all of this for him. And we also see video getting smuggled out. This is a video, and I'm not going to show it to you because it's very disturbing, of protests by the Zimbabwe Council of Trade Unions being broken up in Harare recently. This video was smuggled out through South Africa. We ended up running it on the Global Voices site, and it's a very powerful document of what's going on. So this is all user-generated media. You can imagine that this is making states very, very upset. And when states get upset, they basically react in four different ways. They block access to the sites where the stuff is posted. They try to block the tools to prevent the stuff from being posted. They try to register bloggers in one fashion or another. And finally, they actually threaten their physical safety. So in Ethiopia, which has gone very aggressively against politically dissenting blogs, you're not going to be able to see a site like Nazaret.com, which is probably the leading Ethiopian opposition news site. In Pakistan, you're not going to be able to access Blogger.com. And the reason for this is that Pakistan, in attempting to block six sites that they considered very, very offensive on anti-Islamic grounds, ended up blocking the entirety of Blogger. So any blogger site and the blogger interface is no longer accessible. Now, there's a wonderful movement in Pakistan called Don't Block the Blog, which is trying very hard to let people get to these tools through proxies and tools like Tor. Yeah?
I actually work in Blogger, and that was just posted last week.
That's fantastic. That's great. We haven't seen much of that filter back. So that's great news. Thank you. This is Mahmoud from Bahrain. He's been leading a protest having to do with forcing people to register blogs in Bahrain. And the fear there is that if you have to register your blog, there may be real constraints over what you choose to have there. And finally, one thing that you may have heard of at this point is Abdelkarim Nabil Suleiman is an Egyptian blogger who has recently been sentenced to 4 years in prison for writings on his blog, which were considered defamatory both towards the president and towards Islam. There's now a very active campaign working to get him released. But ultimately, states can exert a huge amount of control over bloggers by actually imprisoning them. There's a bunch of ways we can fight back. One of the interesting things we can do is we can mirror sites. Isaac Mao is one of the leading free speech advocates in China, as well as a Chinese entrepreneur. His site gets blocked every couple of weeks, near as we can tell. And he has a lovely system that happens where when Isaac Mao is blocked on the DNS level, you will get redirected to a site that says, "This is not IsaacMao.com. My site is being blocked. Here's what's going on." And we're now setting up a series of mirror sites around the world to let people get to it. In some cases, the key is to ensure that someone is able to protect their identity so they can blog from a very sensitive place. This is a now defunct blog called Sleepless in Sudan. And this was put together by a woman who was an aid worker in Darfur who knew that there was a very, very strong chance that she would be thrown out of the country and potentially that her organization would be closed down if the Sudanese government found out that she was blogging. And so we set up a solution for her to blog with a high deal of anonymity. She was able to blog from this refugee camp. Ultimately, Nick Kristof took enough interest in her writing that we were able to broker an introduction, and Nick went over and met with her. So there's a guide that I maintain on anonymous blogging using WordPress.org and the Tor software. There's also a very useful guide from Reporter Sans Frontières called the Handbook for Bloggers and Cyber Dissidents, which is very useful for people working in these spaces. Finally, I just want to say the thing that's most important is bringing attention to this notion that people are blocking access to these tools for speech. And we can't just advocate for the blogs that we want to see. We gotta advocate for all of them. And this is getting trickier and trickier because very different groups of people are using blogs. Right now, there are a lot of people within the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt who have started blogging. And this is likely to start a very, very sharp crackdown on online speech in Egypt. This is the country that already has put Karim in prison. I think it's critically important that those of us who want to fight for free speech online, fight for speech online for everybody. And not necessarily just the people who are pushing pro-democratic reforms, but everybody who is trying to speak in countries where speech isn't free. Thanks.
Thanks, Ethan. Shava.
Hi. My name's Shava Nirad, and I'm the executive director of the Tor Project, and we produce, we've applied for our 501c3 as a research and development nonprofit. And an educational nonprofit. And what we do is we produce a suite of software, which is also called Tor, which the client is used by people who want to be able to either circumvent firewalls or protect their identities online. And then there's server software, There are about 1,000 proxy servers all over the world that are run by volunteers. And when you connect through Tor as a client, you basically get randomly routed through this cloud of proxies. Without going into too much of the geekiness of it, basically by the time you come out of the cloud, people can see what you were writing, but they can't see where you came from. So my elevator pitch to a lot of people, well, they say, well, what do you do? I say, we're one of the reasons that people can blog about democracy in China and not end up with a knock on their door at midnight. Because every time somebody blogs, you connect through the internet, your internet address can trace back to a physical location. And you can see in places where you're saying things that are risky, whether they're risky to the local government, risky to an employer, risky because you're whistleblowing, or, you know, because you're a human rights worker working someplace and you need to report on human rights abuses. All of these different things can put you at risk. There are a lot of ordinary reasons why people want anonymity too. I think people should have an expectation that they can be anonymous on the internet as they would be in person, you know, in the real world. One of the things I'd like to emphasize, though, in this panel is that we talk a lot about free speech as though it were an absolute good which everybody should have immediately right now. I think that's a lovely idea. A lot of my family comes from places in the world where free speech has not been a cultural norm for a long time. And when we talk in the United States about the oppression that happens, for example, in China, we talk about it as though it's an absolute. And in actuality, there are the things like our circumvention technology, Siphon. There are a lot of different alternatives that people use to try to protect themselves as they speak out in these countries. This is a safety valve. I think most of these countries that are the medium suppression sort of countries or the light suppression countries realize that free speech is something which is Darwinianly successful and sort of inevitable, but they're trying to manage change. China doesn't shut down free expression, but they do throttle it. And their enforcement of their own laws is a little bit chimerical. We had a situation last year, 2 weeks before the Tiananmen anniversary, where there are proxy servers in China where people go so that they can read about capitalism or democracy or Paris Vogue, you know, anything there is that might end up being blocked from China. They shut down all the proxy servers that people were walking into 2 weeks before the Tiananmen anniversary. And they didn't say, we're going to let you resume operations later. They just said, you're shutting down. A week after the Tiananmen anniversary, they went back to them and said, okay, you can start operations again and let people subvert the Great Firewall from these commercial businesses. So it's not as monolithic as we tend to see it in American media. It's a process. And when I see people in the United States blogging about free expression, a lot of times they're doing it and sitting there going, you know, our version of free expression is good, these people are bad, they're jailing bloggers. You have to see it as sort of what I describe my job as is a live-action role-playing game involving internet diplomacy. You have to see it as an ongoing story having to do with cultural tensions. And so it's important to have the tools available that allow people to do this, but I think it's just important in America and the places where we have at least guarantees of free speech, even though sometimes we can't always speak as freely as we would like without consequences, that we understand that there's a process going on, and in our activism, we should be working with that process, not vilifying the other side. And if anybody wants to find out more about Tor afterwards, and you want to talk about the technical aspects, I'm happy to do that not going to do that on this panel.
Shahid?
Okay, so my name is Shahid Amanullah. I'm the editor of a website called altmuslim.com that discusses issues within the Muslim world from a kind of critical perspective. And more specifically, we also are trying to cultivate a Muslim blogosphere both in the West and in the Muslim world through awards ceremonies that we have every year and advocacy for bloggers as well. As you can see in several of the maps you've seen, a great deal of what's happening with respect to repressions of freedoms on the internet are happening in Muslim countries. And you have to ask yourself, why is that the case? What is it about the Muslim world that is making it kind of a hotbed for this kind of repression? I mean, you have political instability, you have undemocratic regimes or regimes of questionable natures, and you have the rise of extremism, and that's of course due to the fact that Islam is in flux, trying to grapple with modernity, and that's why you have that kind of environment. But why should we care about that? What is it about the Muslim world that brings this all about, and what should we do about it? Well, the Muslim world, first of all, deserves political and press freedoms just like anybody else. I don't think they should be kind of written off as backward or hopeless in terms of their fight for this, in terms of the Muslim masses. Secondly, there's a need for an environment of free expression in order to create a moderate and dynamic type of Islam, an Islam that is in sync with modernity in the 21st century. And you're not going to you don't have that in so many parts of the Muslim world. And the only part that's starting to kind of break through that is on the blogosphere. And so that's why that should be promoted as well. And we all have a stake in what happens in that kind of battle. I mean, 9/11 was a reminder that the turmoil that happens in the Muslim world can't just be contained there. And those people in the Muslim world that are trying to grapple with those issues, trying to come to an understanding of how Islam fits in the modern world, need to be supported both by Muslims in the West and also by their friends in the West who are not Muslim. Bloggers in the Muslim world are kind of unique when you compare them to bloggers in China and other places, in that obviously you have governments that are trying to oppose a lot of what they do, especially when they invoke Islam, because a lot of these governments, even if they're not legitimate, they wrap themselves in the cloak of respectability by kind of being a steward of their kind of Islam. And the minute you start asking questions about that, you're not just asking kind of religiously threatening questions, you're threatening something that keeps them in power. But there's a whole other dimension towards bloggers in the Muslim world. They also get it from the other side, from the extremists, the ones that are trying to shape Islam into something that drives a political or moral agenda. You see, of course, just in general with press freedoms, it's tough to run a bookstore in the Muslim world that's really open. It's tough to say things about social and cultural mores in the Muslim world publicly without somehow getting flack for it, either literally or figuratively. So despite that, despite kind of getting it from both ends, as has been mentioned, Muslims are coming out on the blogosphere and trying to assert themselves because there are so few outlets and because Muslims desperately, the masses I mean, desperately want to join the modern world and get their voices out and kind of get out of this crossfire between the extremists and these repressive governments. But how does blogging get us there? I mean, one of the things that I do on my side is I'm trying to kind of try articulate kind of the basis of a vision for Islam that's in sync with technology, modernity, etc., and is kind of a partner in the world. It does start with the simple questions. I mean, you know, when a Saudi girl asks why she can't drive, but you know, she can be driven around by some strange man. You know, it's not a simple. I mean, it's a simple question with much greater and bigger ramifications. And it's those few simple questions in an environment where people are not used to asking those questions that start the ball rolling. And we've already seen that, you know, in the media in general, in the Muslim world, but the bloggers are really kind of still the vanguard of that. They're asking the questions that have never been asked, and they're kind of daring to do that. It breaks the monopoly on information. You know, first it was the governments, and now it's getting better, but you still have kind of media companies that are, you know, in partnership with governments that know which side of their bread is buttered. And this really does break that monopoly. On that, where that kind of understanding between kind of corporate media and governments in the Muslim world that let's not talk about certain things. The bottom line is that the freer the discourse is on Islam, the more moderate and modern the practice is. And I think you can look at, for example, Muslims in America as an example of that. You know, the more you're able to speak about things freely and discuss things and debate things and come to kind of that kind of understanding, the more harmonious that community is with its neighbors, the more fairer they are with treatment to women, towards women, and the list goes on. So it's almost like a linear correlation you could draw. And that's why I particularly, side on the more free speech side of things. I know it's not an easy thing for a lot of Muslim countries to grapple with going from kind of one extreme to the other, but in the end, it will be good for Islam, it will be good for the Muslim world. So how can we help? Obviously, the first thing we can do is use technology to pry the doors open from the outside. I mean, I'm really hoping for the day where governments will throw up their hands and say it's just futile for us to keep doing this. You know, we might as well battle ideas with ideas and not battle ideas with jackbooted thugs. So that's one thing. The second thing is to read and publicize the work of these bloggers. I think many of these countries that fall into that kind of that middle realm that was talked about earlier are eager to secure investment to make themselves look like good global citizens, etc. And they can be shamed into doing the right thing if we do it right. And, you know, we have to advocate for the popular bloggers. We have to advocate for the not popular bloggers. And make it known that people are watching, and people are watching your reaction, you, the governments, to what these people write. And we will judge you based on how you treat these people. A third thing is basically the reduction of anarchy in the Muslim world. And this goes to the kind of the rise of extremism, because just there's also a linear correlation between extremism and kind of political instability as well. That's a bigger kind of political question, but, you know, it does play a role in what you see happening. I have a friend who went to Iraq to try to start a free newspaper there and promptly got chased out at gunpoint by extremists within about 6 months of starting his paper. And so, I mean, there's real issues, and that's something I think more the Muslim world itself internally has to deal with and kind of come to grips with. We definitely have to advocate for persecuted bloggers and bloggers in general. I don't think it's a good idea. Some people at the State Department asked me, should we go ahead and, you know, say the U.S. specifically advocate for a particular blogger? And I think that's a bad idea because, you know, first of all, these bloggers aren't pro-U.S. necessarily. They don't want to be labeled pro-U.S. because whatever their legitimacy they have in changing hearts and minds within their own societies will be completely taken away from them if they're seen as puppets of the U.S. And so, Western governments can kind of push for general press freedoms and tie that to economic ties and things like that. And I think that's very helpful. But then that leaves the task of advocating for these bloggers to us, to the rest of the blogosphere, to those concerned citizens outside that realm who can do the work of shaming them into doing the right thing. So thanks a lot. And it's great to be on a panel with such wonderful and talented people.
Thanks.
Yes, Mina.
Do you hear me? Is this working? Number 6?
Yeah,
okay. Hello. My name is Jasmina Tešanović, and I come from Serbia. And you can't see it really on my badge, because the moment I came to be registered here, I lost my surname and my country. My surname, because the letters Tešanović, the computer could not accept them. And my country, Serbia, because it's my new country, that's how it's called. The computer cannot accept it. And instead it wrote Yugoslavia. It's a country which is dead for past 10 years, you know. So now I'm Jasmina, just Jasmina from Yugoslavia, you know. And this is the story of my life. And this is the story I'm going to tell you now, you see, because I'm the case study of what you're talking now. So, in the beginning of the 90s, when the fall of Yugoslavia started, I was a feminist activist, Women in Black. You know, I don't know if you know the group. It's an international feminist pacifist group, and a writer. And I was already online, you know. And we started with those terrible wars, you know, in former Yugoslavia, where Serbs were the aggressors, my country. And everybody was asking me, you know, people from all over the world, how are you? What's happening there? What the hell is happening there? You know, so every day I would be writing letters in three languages, in English, in Italian, in Serbo-Croatian. This is happening, that is happening to different people. So I decided to write one kind of letter for everybody. And this was something less than journalism. I was already a journalist at the time, you know, but more than a personal diary. Actually, it was a blog before the word blog was invented, you know. So I was writing this diary, blog. I was sending it out to the mailing list, to my friends. They were putting on the mailing list. So the information went out. And at the end of this process, in the first 4 or 5 years, I had a book on refugees' voices from former Yugoslavia, women and children mostly, because there were refugees, coming back as a feedback through the internet, you know? And the book was published also in the United States. Now, in 1999, when Serbia was bombed by NATO, this is the second phase, I had this surreal situation. I was sitting in my flat in downtown Belgrade with my satellite dish on, you know, and the TV, CNN, and other BBCs, you know, it was like a religious moment that to watch the NATO briefings in the afternoon at 5, you know, p.m. And I had this surreal situation that I was seeing myself bombed on the TV while I was bombed, you know. But, you know, it was some kind of information because, of course, Milosevic, the dictator under whom we lived, you know, all these years, was lying. His TV was lying all the time. All the info we got from the national TV was lies. And I knew that. But what I found out at that moment, that NATO was not telling the truth. Because, you know, I had, for example, I'll just give you one example, not to speak about Chinese embassy, you know, which is a big mystery, why Chinese embassy was bombed in Belgrade. But the concrete example I'm giving you now is that I have, when a southern town in Serbia was bombed, I have relatives living there, and I was very worried. I phoned them, and I said, what happened there? And this relative of mine said, well, you know, I was on the window, and we saw some cluster bombs falling on the marketplace, and lots of civilians were killed. And this is called like collateral damage in NATO language. In Milosevic language, there were no killings at all because we're not in war, and nobody was bombing us, and, you know, like we're winning the war all the time, complete, absolute lies. But in NATO language, collateral damage didn't happen, and it didn't matter. So at that point, what I realized that there were some kind of invisible victims whom both sides were denied. At that point, I started writing out my blog, not only to my friends, but also to my foes. So I was writing to NATO pilots, to their families, like, you know, I hope you all survive. I hope you know what you're doing, you know. And this went on for a month or two. At that point, a friend of mine who lived in London, she wrote to me and said, look, this is your diary. I'm receiving it on my NetTime, it was NetTime mailing list, and it doesn't have your name. A woman from Corriere della Sera, which is main daily in Milan, she wrote to me and said, look, is this your diary perchance? You know, there is no name on, you know, but I think it's your diary. A woman from Croatia claimed that it was her diary, a Serb for Croatia. And ABC TV reached me by phone, and they asked me for an interview, saying, we think it is you, but do you want to give us an interview? And I said, yes, I'm going to give you an interview, sure. Come. And they said, we can't come because we want to protect you. We took your name away because we want to protect you. At that point, what dawned on me is that Milosevic could kill me anytime and his police, because women in black were target. My diary was out in the world. Random looters could kill me anytime because it's a war situation with martial law. NATO could kill me all the time. You know, I mean, bombings, just collateral damage. Public was my only protection. You know, really, public sphere. At that point, I wrote a letter saying, my name is Jasmina Tešanović. I live in Belgrade. I'm the author of the diary of the political idiot. Public is my only protection. I don't want to be part of the missing people. If you miss me, this is my address, politicalidiot@yahoo.com. And I still live there. That's it.
Excellent. Thank you.
We can take questions now. There's a microphone, or, you know, just talk very loud. Okay.
Thank you.
We... Okay. We should use the microphone for questions if we can. I'll repeat this. The question was, do people use anonymity to spread lies? And are we pressured to give up information on those people, like one would give up the source for a media story? Good, yeah. I'm actually a former DENIAC, and I've run political campaigns. I ran a mayoral campaign in Portland, Oregon, at one point. And I'm very familiar with the issues of rumor mill and media distortion that can happen in campaigns, whether they're for politics or issues or God knows products these days. We don't know who uses the network. It's an anonymity network. If we knew who used it, it wouldn't be anonymous. If you can give anyone anonymity, so if we want anonymity for journalists and human rights workers and whatnot, it means that we can't look at the traffic or the content or where it's going or what's going on with it. So nobody can pressure us particularly for any kind of information about it because we don't keep it. Now, we do know that we do get complaints from people. For example, recently I got a complaint that somebody had used Tor to establish an anonymous blog which was publishing photos of the babes of the best law schools in the United States. And a woman contacted me completely irate that we were sheltering these people who were being incredibly rude to women law students. It was a very sexist site. I went and looked at it. But we don't monitor that. There are ways that you can violate anonymity, and all it takes really is keeping Flash or ActiveX or any of those multimedia plugins that can bypass proxy stuff. So there are people who use the system who do end up getting caught when they do one thing or another. But there's no way for us to give up that information. If there were, I'd have a much harder job.
You're in kind of a tough spot there. Because, on the one hand, you're advocating for free speech, but on the other hand, you have what is essentially a misuse of the system. And what can you say?
Well, we actually have real-world analogies for that because, for example, we know that people use the postal mail to spread lies, to send child pornography, to do all kinds of things that we might not like that are speech. But on the other hand, we agree as a social consensus that we don't allow people to open up everybody's mail to look for things that might be not legal or not nice or not true.
Shahed, you mentioned the idea of getting to a point where we battle ideas with ideas. And my question to all the panelists is, Tor does a wonderful job. Some would say it's solved the problem of allowing anonymous publishing, of allowing voices to be heard from anywhere. My question is how we move, the U.S., Russia, everywhere where a more insidious censorship occurs to a true battling of ideas against ideas and not just kind of the yellow state that seems to cover a lot of the map, and I would argue covers a lot of what is green on the map as well.
A lot of the work that we do over at Global Voices is very much trying to get this sort of dialogue between countries, people in different countries, people in different places, people from different ideological points of view. And anonymity is a tiny piece of it. And if it is in fact a piece at all, one of the funny things is I spend a lot of time advocating for people being able to speak anonymously, and then when I give those talks, I usually spend 10 minutes begging people not to speak anonymously. Because with the full, understanding of my friends over at Tor and such, because ideally if you really do want to have these battles of ideas, you need people to stand up and, if possible, stand behind what they're saying. What's really tricky is that we're at this really unique moment in the development of the internet, which is we've been on a largely English-speaking internet for the last 15 years or so. And it's really in the last 2 or 3 years, as we've headed towards 1 billion users and beyond, that we're actually seeing a net that could theoretically connect the whole world. And the trick is that it isn't a single net. And it isn't a single net because countries are actually working very hard to keep groups away from certain bits of information. But even more than that, it isn't a single net because we aren't choosing to talk to one another. And there's cultural barriers to that. There's linguistic barriers to that. Getting around them is huge. You know, over at GV, we translate from about 12 languages at this point. And that's an enormous amount of work just to get you to the point where you can read what someone's saying in Swahili or what someone's saying in Serbian, which is, in fact, one of the languages we translate from. Yeah. But then you have to translate into other languages for people to look at it. So now we've started publishing content in Chinese and French. But then what happens when those people want to talk to each other? I mean, these sorts of questions end up being enormous and vast. I think the important thing, as far as I'm concerned, is holding on to that hopeful vision that maybe we're actually working on this same common framework. Maybe this really should be a network where we all have the chance to talk, despite the fact that the barriers towards actually having that conversation are absolutely vast.
One of my favorite anecdotes about ideas to ideas, I get a lot of people telling me stories, which is great because I consider myself at heart to be a storyteller. In Belarus, they haven't actually established a huge bastion of internet censorship and firewalls and all this kind of stuff. I get a report back from a group that deals with media issues in Belarus saying that one of the reasons that they haven't done that is because, gosh, you know, we could do this stuff, but look, every place else, you know, there are these circumvention tools, there's Tor, there's this, that, there's that. Putting together this stuff isn't really effective. And so there's sort of a, in the realm of doing idea to idea, I think that there's a mimetic sort of storytelling element that people have as they go from country to country. China could shut down Tor. I could tell you technically how they could do it. You know, they could do it tomorrow. But we know that there are ministers of information in some of these countries who sit there and say, oh, but, you know, we can't really shut down Tor. After all, if you could shut down Tor, wouldn't China have done it? So the issues that we have are largely diplomatic and wars of ideas and such like, in addition to, you know, being these issues of open conflict. There are many, many layers.
You know, just to mention, and this is not really a free speech issue so much, but just the issue of communication, the issue of understanding. I mean, I'm sure many of you saw this film Babel, which was sort of about that. We can have conversations and have those conversations not convey meaning. And that's something else. That, I mean, that's probably a different panel, but I think that's something that we should be thinking about, too. There's a question of having free speech, and then there's a question of having speech that actually accomplishes what it's really supposed to accomplish, which is, you know, essentially it's sort of like our best path to telepathy. How do we read each other's minds? Well, we talk to each other. Anyway.
Thank you.
Actually, if I could add one really quick anecdote to that. I'm always asked by people that, you know, how come Muslims aren't fighting extremism over the internet? Because the internet is where kind of extremism is propagated in the Muslim world. And I've even been asked that by various departments within the U.S. government. And one of the things I say is that, you know, I know so many people that would want to go there and battle idea versus idea, you know, to kind of fight extremist ideas down. But, you know, and we know where all those sites are, but we're all so afraid to go to them because the NSC is going to be knocking on the door the next day saying, what are you doing visiting that site? And so I actually threw a gauntlet down to the NSC. I said, if you can figure out a way to protect people who want to go do this battle of ideas and ensure that they're not going to be hunted down by the U.S. government, I will do my best to recruit people to do that. But until you do, I'm telling them all, these are the sites, stay away from them. So, I mean, that's the dilemma we're in. I mean, I want to get that idea thing going.
Next question.
Thanks for a great panel. I thought of this when Ethan was talking because you listed Burma as one of the most, you know, most thoroughly repressive states. And I was thinking about Aung Zhao's Irrawaddy publication out of Thailand, which is a, you know, continuous commentary on events in Burma. And I thought for Yasmina and probably for Shahed and you, Ethan, maybe anybody, I'd like for you to talk more about the... we think of the internet as this big disembodied thing, and in many ways it is placeless, but what is the specific role, the ongoing role for what's been, you know, hundreds of years tradition of an expatriate press?
Sure. Well, so it's a terrific point, and that phenomenon that you're talking about, where essentially you don't have a free press in the country, but you have a free press in a bordering country. We can find examples of that all over the world at this point. I don't do much work in Burma these days. I do a lot of work in Zimbabwe, and we have the same phenomenon there, where if you're a Zimbabwean journalist, you are either deeply, deeply underground, or you're in either South Africa or Botswana. And if you want to find out what's actually going on in Zimbabwe, you need to read the Mail and Guardian, which is published by Zimbabweans in South Africa rather than anything published in Zimbabwe. One of the most interesting things is that this space that we work with in Global Voices is a space of people that I've largely started talking about as people from the fourth world, which is to say people who are sort of post-national. People who may have chosen for economic reasons or for political reasons or for educational reasons to leave their home countries. But this sort of global population of expatriates and migrants is sort of emerging as a new social class. And this is one of the media that group of people uses very, very heavily. It's important not only in countries that are highly repressive, although it's very important there. It's also becoming very important in electoral politics. So, for instance, in a country like Senegal, which just had an election, a lot of that electoral debate took place on the internet between expatriate Senegalese who weren't going to be home to vote, but very much wanted to sway the vote in one fashion or another. So I think acknowledging that this is very much a space where you can have dialogue between expatriates and people who live in the countries is a critical piece of things.
Can I say something? We have in Serbia now an interactive blog, blog B92, you know, it's put up like 6 months ago, 9 months ago, you know. And in a couple of months, it became the media most read in Serbia. You know, it has like 600 comments, up to 600 comments, 30,000 reads per day, you know, which is a lot. It's much more than any daily press. And why is that? Because it's the only free non-censored media, you know, in Serbia. Otherwise, it's censored either from economical or political reasons. And people are registered on pseudonyms, you know, real names and what. And there's a huge discussion between the expatriates. And there are also famous people are pseudonyms, you know, people who are like victims of previous policies, you know, who are coming out with truth, you know. And every now and then we have attacks from hackers, you know, and the site, which is based actually in Holland somewhere, is attacked and it goes down, you know, because also we have bad software like Drupal, sorry. But we have to update it. It just can't put up with all this, you know, but really it's one of the, for example, I don't erase any comments. I just keep them all there because I want also the, you know, the racist, the fascist, whatever, because I want to see where I'm living and what people think. And I'm collecting the hate mail for UN research, you know, because they want us, Charlotte Bunch from UN, you know, she's a feminist activist and also a writer, you know, professor. She wants me to see, to collect all the racist, fascist, and anti-feminist things, and we are to have the global picture, you know, to see the globalization of this kind of phenomenon.
I'd just like to add a word to that as well, if I could quickly. Is that a lot of the value of this informal media space outside of the country is probably in informing the rest of the world. And the sad fact is that the people in Burma are very well of the repression they're living on. And it's they're a long way from really benefiting from a more vibrant blog space there.
Jean Davison and I work in a lot in African countries, in Zimbabwe, Ethiopia, you know, a lot of these countries. And my concern, because I work with people out in villages, is the disconnect, is the global gap, the blogging gap between those who have access to the system to be able to blog and the people I work with who don't, because they don't have electricity. What responsibility do people like your organizations feel towards those people to see that they get the infrastructure to make it possible and then to protect them?
Good question.
It's a huge question. The last NGO I ran was a digital divide organization focused on West Africa, focused specifically on that project. The trick there is that the economic barriers are utterly enormous. So the work that we were doing sort of when I stepped down from that particular group was linking community radio in Mali with these new technologies. So part of this is not just getting the infrastructure out there, it's also dealing with people who are at very low levels of literacy. Community radio plus mobile phones is the equivalent of blogs in much of the developing world. If you're hanging out in Accra, Ghana, where I used to have my offices, you will hear more political opinion expressed in any given day just by turning on the radio and having people sort of represent themselves that way. So I think there are real obligations to try to build that bridge, and I think specifically that bridge between blogs and community radio. This is still very much an elite medium. But what's critical about it is that it's an elite medium that actually does have a global audience. And where I'm trying to focus on this is sort of finding ways to amplify those voices that are able to get online, most of which are urban voices. Increasingly, we're getting more and more rural voices, and get them out to a larger audience. But it has to happen in conjunction with other efforts.
Also, just to address part of that, we started out as a project that was based on people who had good technology and good computers and good computer links in 2000 to 2003. Last year, I started with a project. My background is in digital divide issues, and one of the things that we're doing is we're seeking funding to make sure that tools like Tor work at least the low end, the cyber cafe in Iran where there are six P2s sharing a 56 KB modem line, those sort of situations. It's not really within our scope, although we work with groups that are doing digital divide push out and, you know, talk to them about how to prepare for the social phenomenon that might happen with that. I brainstorm with people about that. But we're very aware of it as an issue of free speech.
Hi, my name is Jonah Boswich. I was hoping that you could all talk a little bit more about the importance of these tools in the modern and Western worlds, and especially to the extent that the countervailing forces of omniscient surveillance are making this a real reality here, too. I've been very, very closely following the Zyprexa scandal, where here in the United States, these tools were central in the ability for this action to take place. And the challenge of safely and anonymously blowing a whistle in a world of omniscient surveillance is one that, we all face right now.
I have to say that, that mindfreedom.org, started out on the Eugene Freenet back when I was, general manager there. So I've been, doubly involved in the Zyprexa stuff. Whistleblowing is a big deal, because usually whistleblowing is done by people on the exact computer systems, often enough, of the people who they're whistleblowing on. We have a lot of dynamics having to do with whistleblowing, which are not obviously necessarily against states, but against powerful corporations. Sometimes those overlap. I know some people who work in health activism in Africa, who their issue with whistleblowing is that if they budget 10% for corruption, when it goes up to 25%, as my friend said, not only can they not afford it, but it becomes dangerous to complain. So they actually use anonymity to go out of the country and come back in and report the corruption from outside of the country so that they can preserve their physical safety. I know people who use anonymity in upstate New York. A single mother who is living in and working for the company in a company town who's trying to organize around labor issues, and the real world repercussions on her would be high. So free speech is something that runs through a lot of our life and is not really well guarded. I encourage people to check out some websites like EFF.org, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and EPIC.org, which I can never remember what EPIC stands for. The Privacy Information, Electronic Privacy Information Clearinghouse. There we go. For some of the issues that have to do with privacy and anonymity and free speech within our own borders. Privacy International is another resource for this sort of stuff internationally. It is a problem no matter where you are, and to a certain extent, no matter what you're doing.
Actually, this is maybe a good time for me to make a plug. The Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF, has a big party. EFF Austin organizes it every year. It's going to be Monday night at Schultz Garten at 7 o'clock. So if you want to meet the EFF folks, show up there. What's our time like? Can I get a time check back there?
It's 12:30, so I think we're
okay. I think we're done. Thank you very much.